This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Thursday, October 2nd, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. The commander of American forces in Iraq said today, nearly 6 months after the fall of Baghdad, U.S. troops are suffering an average of 3 to 6 deaths and 40 wounded every week. The enemy has evolved a little bit more lethal, a little bit more complex, a little bit more sophisticated, and in some cases, a little bit more tenacious, said Lieutenant General Ricardo Sanchez. The evolution is about what we expected to see over time. He says American forces are being attacked 15 to 20 times a day, counting roadside bombs, mostly in Baghdad and the surrounding Sunni stronghold to the west and north of the capital. Since May 1st, when President Bush declared the end of major combat, an estimated 90 soldiers have died in combat, according to an Associated Press tally. A total of 314 American service members have died since the war started March 20th. That's according to the U.S. Defense Department. The investigation into the leak of a CIA officer's name is likely to expand to other Bush administration agencies, including the State and Defense Departments. A senior Justice Department official, speaking on condition of anonymity, said those agencies and possibly others could get letters urging officials to preserve documents such as phone logs and not to delete emails. Similar letters have already gone to the White House and CIA. Defense Department officials confirmed today that they were told to expect such a letter. At the State Department, spokeswoman Susan Pittman said she did not know if a letter had been received, but that the agency would cooperate fully if asked. Preventing loss of evidence is a key part of the early stage of the FBI's investigation, which is focused at the outset on narrowing the list of government officials who may have known the CIA officer's identity. White House spokesman Scott McClellan told reporters today that the White House had not received any subpoenas in the investigation and that, to his knowledge, no staffers had been interviewed by the FBI. Pakistan's army launched its largest offensive against al-Qaeda and other militants in a rugged tribal region bordering Afghanistan today, killing at least 12 suspects and arresting 18, military officials said. An Associated Press reporter at the scene saw 4 bodies. Major General Amir Faisal, the commander of the operation, said 8 other bodies were lying in an area about 100 yards away that was too dangerous to enter. 10 al-Qaeda suspects, blindfolded and with their hands tied behind their backs, were seen being led away from the area. The military said 18 suspects were detained in all. One of the first actions taken by U.S. forces during the invasion of Iraq was to secure the oil fields and the oil ministries of Iraq. Prior to the invasion, Peace Watch presented a discussion with Ambrose Lane Sr., host of the program We Ourselves on Pacifica Station WPFW in Washington, D.C. Lane spoke of the battle between the euro and the U.S. dollar in world financial markets and as the reserve currency for the United States. Iraq had begun using the euro instead of the U.S. dollar for the U.N.-sanctioned oil for food program, which severely weakened the value of the dollar in markets abroad. After the most recent war, the U.N. lifted its sanctions on the sale of Iraqi oil that fell outside the provisions of oil for food. The U.S.-appointed government used the opportunity to reinstate the dollar as the currency for the sale for Iraqi oil, and all Iraqi funds and foreign backs were converted from the euro to the dollar. On today's program, Ambrose Lane places our present economic realities in an historical context, and he explores the compelling economic issues that he says were a major impetus for the U.S. invasion of Iraq. His 2-part lecture, which will feature the rest of this week on Peace Watch, is entitled Epicenter of Evil.
What I'm going to do is to lay out for you from a multiple number of resources why the Bush administration is so intent on going to war. I will draw heavily from a piece entitled Research Unit for Political Economy, Bombay, India, which is shortly to be published in the United States by the Monthly Review Press in New York. Part 1. The 1991 United States attack on Iraq in the name of evacuating Kuwait not only caused a terrible immediate loss of life, but systematically and deliberately devastated the entire civilian infrastructure of Iraq. And 11 years of sanctions have wreaked unparalleled devastation in that country's economic life, an effective, what a senior United Nations official termed genocide, by systematically starving the country of elementary needs. Under the United States and the United Kingdom, Great Britain, no-fly zones and repeated bombings, both without any legal basis whatsoever, have violated Iraq's sovereignty and security. And under United States and United Kingdom protection, pro-United States Kurdish forces hold sway in northern Iraq. Now, this is where al-Qaeda is supposed to be operating, according to our government. Iraq does not have control there. Only the United States and the Kurds and the British control northern Iraq. And in the guise of weapons inspections, brazen espionage has been carried out by the United States, the United Kingdom, and Israel. Apart from the United Kingdom and Israel and Spain, countries in the rest of the world have either opposed the planned war or at least attempted to distance themselves from it. Public opinion outside of America and Israel is set against the war. And even within highly indoctrinated America is rapidly shifting. Witness the massive anti-war demonstrations. Now we have to look at the manner in which this president was able to ram through Congress his demand for sweeping and open-ended war powers. And it makes clear that the corporate sector as a whole, not only the oil companies, is vitally interested in this war. It is significant that despite recession and economic uncertainty, despite deepening budget and balance of payment deficits, this country is willing to foot the bill, at least the leadership is, for a massive, open-ended military operation. Evidently, American corporations believe the potential reward will justify the war, or that the failure to go to war will have grave consequences for them. You see, in this country that we call democracy, the people's voice is not heard. Now, the immediate reward is a massive oil grab on a scale not witnessed since the days of colonialism. Caspian prospects pale in comparison with Iraqi oil wealth. Iraq has the world's second largest reserves, at present 115 billion barrels, but long-delayed exploration may take that figure to as high as 250 billion barrels. Moreover, its oil is, along with that of Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, and Iran, by far the cheapest oil to extract from the earth. And this country is quite openly offering the French and Russians, who have giant contracts with the present Iraqi regime that cannot be realized because of the sanctions, slices of the post-invasion cake in exchange for their approval in the Security Council. All of this has been explicitly spelled out in various policy documents authored by or commissioned by those now in charge in the United States military and foreign policy. Not only is the United States leadership increasingly dependent on West Asian oil for its own consumption, its capture of this oil is also intended to secure its supremacy among imperialist powers. There is a new dollar bill on the world scene. It's called the euro, and it's the coin of the new realm, the European Union. This euro now poses a credible alternative to the status of the dollar as the global reserve currency, threatening our crucial ability to fund our deficits by soaking up the world's savings. Our country anticipates that the capture of Iraq will directly benefit its corporations, that is oil, arms, engineering, financial, even as it shuts out the corporations from other imperialist countries. Further, it intends to prevent the bulk of petroleum trade being conducted in euros instead of dollars, and thus maintain the dollar's supremacy. In a broader sense, it believes that such a reassertion of its supremacy in military terms and in control of strategic resources will prevent the emergence of any serious imperialist challenger, such as the European Union. The present campaign is in line with the Pentagon's 1992 defense planning guidance, which called for preventing any other major power from acquiring the strength to develop into a challenger to America's solitary supremacy. That was the document produced while Daddy Bush was still president and expected to be reelected. But along came Bill Clinton. For these very reasons, the United States is facing more serious opposition from France, Germany, and Russia in relation to Iraq than on any strategic issue in the past. Since the collapse of the Soviet Union, no imperialist power has had the military muscle to oppose U.S. unilateralism, and other powers have focused instead on getting their minor share of the spoils of the former Soviet Empire and the intensified plunder of the Third World. These powers, however, see that the present campaign is intended precisely to shut them out of contention for equal status with our country in the long term as well. Contention for such status is the very reason the European Union exists. Direct control over the region's petroleum resources will give this country another important lever to use also against China, which will become considerably more dependent on petroleum imports during the next decade. The U.S. also sees capitalist China as a potential threat to its plans for domination of East and Southeast Asia. The United States has taken various steps to block China's plans to obtain independent, stable access to West Asian oil or Caspian oil. The United States has already installed its military throughout oil and gas-rich Central Asia. Now it is in the process of doing so in vastly richer West Asia. The United States has now, under George Bush, openly declared the death of the United Nations system. This was the content of Bush's speech to the United Nations, where he declared that it would be irrelevant unless it rubber-stamped U.S. supremacy. As you know, for several years, Senator Jesse Hams held up the United States' contribution to the United Nations. What we're seeing here is power exercise with capitalist passion, not democracy. Democracy, the term, is simply used as a cover for unbridled capitalism. Now, this new doctrine is contained in the United States National Security Strategy document, which declares the right of American preemptive strike against emerging or potential threats, and warns that it is willing to act alone if other imperialist powers do not follow its lead. We are systematically revising the existing international consensus, for example, on the use of nuclear weapons. And if you recall, in 1991, in the previous Gulf War, we used depleted uranium-tipped missiles in blowing up bunkers in Iraq. Now, in order to carry out the plan of the American ruling classes, our government, already overextended, will have to extend itself even further. Not only has it rapidly multiplied its military outposts and involvements across the world, from the Philippines to Asia to Latin America, but it has taken on the status of a direct occupier in Afghanistan and evidently intends to do so in at least Iraq. Anticipating the heavy costs of their new mission, intellectual hacks of the American and British ruling classes are busy preparing theoretical justifications for a new bout of colonialism, an onslaught of propaganda aimed at us, the American people, and the people of the United Kingdom. At the same time, the internal repressive apparatus is being strengthened in our country, and panic, submission to authority, and other elements of fascism are being manufactured. And a lot of it is coming out of Attorney General Ashcroft's office, the FBI, and the new Domestic Security Agency. Now, the simultaneous emergence of worldwide popular opposition and resistance, opposition from other imperialist powers, and the profound weakness in our own economy suggests that events will not develop as our imperialism wishes. Now, Iraq's 11,000-page report to the United Nations Security Council lists 150 foreign companies, including some from America, Britain, Germany, and France, that supported Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction program. Now, this was reported by a German newspaper, Die Tageszeitung. That paper said that it had a copy of the original Iraqi 11,000-page dossier, which was vetted for sensitive information by our U.S. officials before being handed over to the five permanent Security Council members. And then an edited version was passed to the remaining 10 members of the Security Council. What they did was eliminate all references to American companies. But in truth, the German newspaper found, and I quote, "From about 1975 onwards, these companies are shown to have supplied entire complexes, building elements, basic materials, and technical know-how for Saddam Hussein's program to develop nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons of mass destruction." But you see, they tried to hide them from the American people. And so our representatives, our government representatives, got that material and took it out of the 11,000-page report. As our government prepares to launch an invasion of Iraq and perhaps of other countries as well, our economy is trapped in a recession with no clear prospect of recovery. True to their character, most of the world's giant media corporations have not seen fit to tell their readers, viewers, and listeners the truth about this matter. The United States corporate sector knows the truth. Corporate profits and business investments have experienced their steepest decline since the 1930s. That was the advent of the Great Depression. And the U.S. is not alone in its fate. Prospects for a global recovery are bleak. Indeed, the giant overhang of debt and excess capacity dictates that the recession will probably deepen. 3 years ago, economic analysts and the financial press were still celebrating the American economy's seemingly endless capacity for growth. In fact, Alan Greenspan, the head of the United States Federal Reserve, which is our central bank, was treated as a media star for his genius in fine-tuning interest rates. In fact, some even advanced the novel theory that new technology, continuous productivity growth, and globalization had made the American economy recession-proof. But we have a crisis of overproduction in full bloom. Often in times of economic setback, some members of the ruling class press returns to earth and begins to tell their listeners or readers the truth. The Chicago Tribune, in December of 2002, published a series of articles on the current economic crisis, drawing on a wide range of interviews with employers, employees, and economic analysts. The first piece in the series was entitled, "The Economics of Glut. Bloated industries put the economy in a bind. Glut is making it harder to shake off the recession." It was prepared by William Nykerk. The lead article begins, "The world's auto industry can now produce 20 million more cars than consumers can buy." Citing instances also from telecommunications and dot-coms, the Chicago Tribune discovered that, quote, "Economists call the phenomenon overcapacity. Businesses can produce far more than we need. Supply has simply outstripped demand. When that happens," said the Chicago Tribune, "production slows. Equipment sits idle. Costs go up. Workers are laid off, and investments are postponed. The capacity glut exists on a scale that this country and many others haven't seen for decades. And it at least partially explains why it is so difficult for the American economy to shake off a recession." The Tribune saw a swamp of excess capacity in airline, auto, machine tool, steel, textile, and high-tech industries, even commercial space and hotel rooms. And according to the Federal Reserve, manufacturers are using only 73.5% of capacity, far below the 80.9% average for the years 1967 to 2001. The buildup of overcapacity doesn't immediately result in a cutback in investment. Indeed, firms are driven to invest on an even grander scale to outspend their rivals and thereby grab market share away from them, a strategy pursued by all the firms. Now, despite the passage of a 10-year tax reduction package of $1.35 trillion at the behest of George W. Bush, and the Federal Reserve slashing interest rates 12 times over 13 months, the so-called recovery just isn't there. Even more unsettling, said the Chicago Tribune, is the fact that falling prices or deflation have taken hold in the manufacturing sector. Prices of goods have been dropping as a global excess capacity has developed. There are some indications that deflation is beginning to spill over into the services sector in areas like retail trade, which is indirectly related to manufacturing. The United States hasn't had a generalized deflation since the Great Depression in the 1930s. And in a deflationary environment, people postpone purchases in anticipation that prices could be lower in the future. As a result, demand drops. Profits spiral downward, jobs are lost, retrenchment sets in. Now, unemployment rose from 3.9% in September 2000 to 6% in November 2002. 3 million jobs have been slashed, 2 million in manufacturing. A year ago, there were 1 million people who had been unemployed 26 weeks or longer. Now it's more than 1.7 million. And the retrenchments are particularly large in the so-called new economy sectors. In the very brief period between the end of 2000 and the middle of 2002, as more than 60 companies went bankrupt, the telecommunication industry laid off more than 500,000 workers, which is 50% more than it hired in its spectacular expansion between 1996 and 2000. In an article in The Economist, September 28, 2002, the article read, "But by now, the Federal Reserve has shot most of its ammunition. With interest rates and inflation already so low, there's little room for further easing if the economy stumbles. That raises the specter of falling prices, which would be devastating in an economy so awash with debt. As the value of assets for which people have borrowed plummet, this sets off a devastating chain of defaults and bankruptcies throughout the economy." And in an article titled "Stagnation and the Federal Explosion," Harry Magdoff and Paul Sweezy wrote that, in fact, overcapacity in United States industry, and indeed the world, isn't new. It has been a perennial underlying feature of monopoly capital, and so of the American economy. Capital utilization in U.S. manufacturing has been on a steady downward trend since the 1960s. Question: how do such overcapacities develop? Well, capitalists invests in order to earn a profit. And how much they invest, in which industries, using which technologies, and so on, are determined by the prospect for profits. In the course of competing with one another to grab market shares and to maximize their profits, capitalists must continuously expand their productive capacity. The purpose of production under capitalism is to accumulate more capital. However, in this process, the growth of productive capacity soon outstrips demand. Now, we can solve that, you see, by seriously redistributing income throughout society, because that would increase demand. But it would take away some profits from capitalists, which goes against the very reason for the existence of investment under capitalism. So as demand weakens, the profitability of investment declines. Capitalists therefore cut back on investment. Demand for investment goods suffers, and as workers get retrenched, demand for consumer goods further weakens. This is how recessions come about. That's the reason George Bush's tax cuts are insane, because he wants to give the money to the richest so that they can invest more, so we can have more overproduction, more capacity with reduced demand, because the people ain't got no money. Remember that the Great Depression of the 30s persisted throughout the 1930s, despite the fact that wages fail dramatically. Now, unique to capitalism is the strange phenomenon of production falling because of the ability to produce too much.
Ambrose Eilane Sr. is the producer and host of We Ourselves from Pacifica Station WPFW in Washington, D.C. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.
Well, we might end up for our country making handouts in the rain.